welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, everyone. This is Barney Leventino at Syosset Library. Welcome to this chapter of Turn the Page. And I am today very, very excited to welcome our guest, terrific author and just interesting human being, Nathaniel Filbert. Mr. Filbert, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you today.
Before we get into the new book, by the way, is Travels with George in Search of George Washington and His Legacy. And before we get into that, I just have to comment on one of your old books. When we were making the arrangements for today's podcast, I happened to be in Charlottesville, Virginia, visiting my son, my daughter-in-law, meeting my new grandson for the first time. And I was exchanging emails. And at one point I said, oh, this is great. I'm going to have a chance to talk to Nathaniel Filbert. And my son said, oh, wow. A little bit of background, both of my boys are King's Pointers, and they're, if you're not aware, graduates of U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, and my son said, oh, well, aboard every ship he's ever sailed on, there's been a copy of In the Heart of the Sea, and he said, King's Pointers love it, so there you go, there's a plug for your old book.
Hey, well, great.
The new book, Travels with George, a lot of people probably are not even aware of the journeys that George Washington took early on in his presidency. So talk a little bit about that and how you came to approach this newest project.
Yeah, well, you know, Washington became president in 1789, and he was obviously our first American president. He had a lot to figure out, as did the nation. And he quickly realized, though, that, you know, not everybody was on board with this. The process by which the Constitution had been ratified was kind of ugly in many states. And in fact, there were two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, that hadn't ratified the Constitution by the time Washington was sworn in. And he realized he really needed to find a way to pull this nation of 13 very essentially independent states together. And so he decided to go on a series of road trips. His New England tour would take him as far north as Kittery Point, Maine. The longest and most ambitious tour would be the Southern tour that would take him all the way to Savannah, Georgia. It'd take him 3 months, and you know, to places he had never been before. You know, we think of him as a Southerner, but he had never been to South Carolina or Georgia. And so he went on this series of trips over the process of a year and a half to 2 years. And by the end of it, he had visited literally hundreds of little and large towns across the country. And people began to realize that it wasn't just their little town, their state. They were now part of something bigger, the United States.
What I found interesting also about it is Washington, I mean, he was a rock star at the time, but he made it a point on this trip to stay in public taverns, public inns, and try to avoid the homes of, I guess, they would have been the one percenters back then. He was really trying to get down to earth with the people.
Yeah, this is like Billy Joel deciding to stay in Motel Sixes on a tour. I mean, Washington wanted to make a point. He was elected by the people, and he was one of the people. And so he insisted on staying not in private homes, but in public taverns. And these were the motel, you know, motels of their day, you know, often fleas where everywhere, bad bedding, food, even worse. But he was making a point. And so, you know, this was something he was doing, had a lot of symbolic aspects to it. But the fact of the matter is, it required him to go through a really punishing travel regime as he went to see as many of the American people as he possibly could.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, travel back then was not, you know, hopping in your car and heading off. It was, this was really an arduous journey for somebody. Even at that point, he was getting on in years. It had to be difficult, and it had to really be important for him to get out and do this. He broke his travels up into three separate tours. He went first, I guess, up into New England. Mm-hmm. Then he was on Long Island, and then he went south. Did he consciously make the decision to break it up in that way based upon what he thought his reception might be in the various locations?
I think it had more to do with just geography. He was sworn in New York, which was the first temporary capital of the country. And, he could very easily punch into Connecticut after a day's journey to Rye, New York, you know, right on the verge. And but he also knew this was so early in his presidency. He's just, he hadn't even been president 6 months. He really hadn't been time to create a whole cabinet. The agenda of his presidency was just emerging. This was much more a chance for him to get out there and show that, there now is such a thing as a president. I think we take for granted today, that the president runs things, the governors are underneath him, was not obvious then. Up until the Constitution, the governors were the ones with all the power. The states were the ones with the taxing ability. It was not, there was no federal government with any kind of strength. And so this was new. And it could be argued that only someone like Washington, a national and international hero, could have pulled it off. Because, he embodied bipartisanship. Yes, he had his own political agenda, but the fact of the matter is, without him, everyone knew that the revolution would have not gone the way it did. And so he really didn't want to be president, but he realized who else would do it. And so he hit the road.
You talk about that, and it's as president, everything he did was setting a precedent.
Yes.
And an interesting story was up in Boston, his little mm-hmm. jousting with John Hancock. And in terms of the supremacy, I guess you would say, of the federal government versus the governor. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. It's interesting because we were just talking about how he was a man of the people, but he was also making a point that, there was a new leader in town, and a new office, the presidency. And John Hancock and Washington had a somewhat tense relationship throughout the revolution. There's some have argued that Hancock really thought he was going to end up being the commander of the Continental Army rather than Washington. And then when he became governor of Connecticut later in the war, he wasn't very helpful in providing Washington with the provisions and the soldiers he needed. And, he was the top dog in Connecticut, in Massachusetts. And so when Washington came to Boston, Hancock invited him to come over for dinner, and Washington accepted. But what Hancock did not tell Washington was that he wasn't even going to attend the festivities during the day when Washington came, arrived in Boston. And there was a protocol here. Washington felt that a governor should first wait upon a president before a president would then wait upon a governor. And Hancock clearly didn't see it this way. And so when it became clear Hancock was not going to show up, Washington went back to his quarters and wrote a letter to Hancock saying, "I am not coming to dinner. until you see me, I am not going to see you." And Hancock claimed that the gout was so bad that that's why he couldn't come out. And he, very theatrically, had some men carry him into Washington's quarters to beg his forgiveness. Washington accepted it and then eventually did go to Hancock's quarters. But, today it's ludicrously obvious that a president outranks a governor. Up until the time Washington declined Hancock's dinner invitation, it wasn't necessarily that obvious. And so Washington, as you're saying, he was setting precedents, and everything he did carried this enormous weight of establishing not only what was going to happen in his presidency, but potentially all the presidencies to come.
And he was clearly mindful of all of that. I think he was thinking way down the road, thinking that everything I do is going to impact people who follow me.
Yeah, no, and I mean, imagine it. You know, all of us, it's really hard to deal with our own past, you know, but to deal, to be the first in doing something, you have the weight of the future on you. I mean, and that's, talk about pressure. That's posterity. And, you know, and I think one of the interesting things is Washington's health began to suffer almost the day he became president. Not only, you know, he was a very active man, and you know, he was required to stay in his office a lot, but there was also huge tensions involved. And he began to look at these travels as a way to get out of the office, get the exercise he needed, and put all of these pressures in perspective. And so, you know, this was, he not only saved his country, he saved himself by going on this tour of America.
You know, as we're talking, I don't want to give listeners who are not familiar with the book the idea that this is just a straight history book that talks about Washington on such and such a date did this. This book is different on so many levels. It's good on history, but the whole premise of the book is you and your wife and your dog, Dora, set out on this journey to follow Washington. What prompted that? How did it come about? And what led you to take this journey on yourself?
Well, you know, I had just finished a trilogy about the American Revolution, and it was an exhilarating experience. It was 10 years of my life, a lot of very deep research, a lot of blood and guts. It was war. And I finished that, and I said, I don't want to, you know, follow it up with another, violent book. But I was still fascinated with Washington. And I just needed a change. I wanted to get out of my office. You know, for the last 25 years, I've been in my office where I am now, writing. And I just felt like I just needed to get out of the house. I live on Nantucket, you know, an island 30 miles off the coast of Massachusetts. I just wanted to, you know, get out there. And so, you know, I learned more and more about Washington's travels. And my wife was retiring, Melissa. She had been an attorney and then had been the president of a nonprofit. She was retiring, so we had time on our hands. We had just gotten a young puppy, a Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever named Dora. And one of my favorite books of all time is Travels with Charlie. That book begins on Long Island, you know. In fact, Melissa and I had even met Steinbeck's widow, Elaine Steinbeck, on Nantucket years ago. And so I wanted to emulate that in a way, while trying to learn about George's travels. And hopefully this would give, you know, a historical perspective on our own times, which are so politically divided. And so we plotted our journey, much like Washington did. The longer journeys we cut into half just because it was going to take so much time. But, both of us now, it was the most extraordinary experience we've had on the road together. And we both look back to it with extreme nostalgia. I look forward to doing it again at some point in some form.
You mentioned Long Island. I'm sitting here on Long Island. I actually live fairly close to Setauket on Long Island.
Sure. We'll
take Washington's tours a little bit out of order here. And his Long Island tour was a little bit different than the others in terms of he might have had more of a particular purpose. You want to talk about what he was doing here on Long Island?
Yeah. It's, for me, it's one of the more interesting parts of his tour. It was really sort of the under the radar part of the tour. As a lot of your listeners know, Long Island, particularly Setauket, was the center of Washington's spy network during the Revolution. And, you know, no one knew the identities of these spies other than, you know, a few of Washington's intimates and Washington himself. And that's the way the spies wanted it. They did not want their identities revealed because, hey, if this experiment in republicanism should fail and the British come roaring back, you don't want it to be known that you were a spy back in the Revolution. And so their identities were still unknown to their own families. And yet Washington goes on this tour of the western portion of Long Island. There's absolutely no newspaper coverage of it, which is really strange because, you know, all his other trips are all, you know, they're all over the press. He does it in 4 days, and he follows the South Shore, and then he heads up to Setauket, stays at the inn of one of the clearly one of the spies, makes his way to Oyster Bay, you know, yet the home of probably the leading spy who was based in New York during the Revolution. And he, you know, it seems clear that he was privately acknowledging the contribution these people made in winning the Revolution. And so, but it also inevitably, it was Washington, you know, in his carriage. And so people gathered around, they quickly, word got out. And so it's, for me, it's one of the more, you know, fun, you know, he's clearly having a good time. You know, he's in Oyster Bay. And thanks to a 8-year-old girl at the time of Washington's visit, we have this account that was recorded when she was in her 90s living in Greenwich Village. I mean, you know, this is great stuff. And, you know, she recounts she was at the gate of her house in watching, seeing Washington approach on a horse, and they were building a 1-room schoolhouse. You know, Washington was tall. He was 6'2", a giant at the time. And he got off his horse and helped them raise one of the rafters into the roof. You know, this is not the staid, you know, politician slash general who would never crack a smile. You know, this is someone who, you know, rolls up his sleeves and gets out there and just enjoys being out among, you know, visiting the countryside. And so Melissa and I really enjoyed the Long Island portion of our travels.
That's good to hear. It's Setauket has become a real tourist attraction since the interest in the spy ring has gotten in television series and all of that. So that was kind of cool. In New England, Washington kind of exhibited a real interest in manufacturing and in industrial development. And it's funny because, as I mentioned, not too long ago, I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and at Monticello, and speaking to a Jefferson interpreter. And Jefferson's view of the country was really more agrarian. He thought the future of the nation was in lots and lots of small farming operations and really little guys being agrarian and farming. Washington, I think, had a different view of what the economic future of the country would be. And ultimately, I think that kind of engendered a little bit of the conflict that will arise between Washington and Jefferson.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, Washington saw the, and he was aided and abetted in this vision by Alexander Hamilton, that they really saw the future as manufacturing. Because at that point, America was absolutely dependent on British goods, you know, whether it was clothes or, you know, just about anything when it came to manufactured goods. And so Washington really hoped to see a kind of tech boom of the 18th century. And Massachusetts was already emerging as the tech capital of the 13 states. There were the year when he went on his New England tour, there were mills that had just been built in the last year, emulating British technology. And so there was a cloth manufacturer, a cotton mill in Hartford, Connecticut, that had actually made the brown suit he had worn when he was sworn in as president. And so he visited these with the clear intention of saying, this is the future. And you're right, Jefferson did not see it that way. He had seen when he was in Europe as ambassador to France, you know, he had, particularly in England, he had seen what these they call, you know, we call them factories. They were called manufactories then. what it looked like. And the assembly line, they weren't assembly lines yet, but they were, you know, approaching that, and it horrified him. He thought, you know, the ideal American citizen was a farmer. I mean, what he neglected to mention when it came to the South was that slavery was a part of that, which is not the most Republican ideal. Anyways, we won't go down that. But so Washington really had an agenda when he was in New England to encourage this. And it was and the year he did it, it was just on the edge of a cotton spinning mill to be built in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which some have said launched the American Industrial Revolution. And so Washington was all for it. And, you know, hey, face it, looking back now, Washington was right and Jefferson was wrong.
You mentioned the word that I was holding off till the end. I wanted to kind of not veer the discussion off on that, but you mentioned slavery. And obviously, it's a huge topic in the book in terms of what was going on back then. It's an undercurrent throughout his travels. Obviously, in the South, it was a major, major issue. But even in the North, I learned a lot about the impact on the economic situation in the North of Southern slavery in terms of involvement peripherally in the slave trade, but also in shipping goods to the Southern slave owners and plantations. I learned a lot about the history of your alma mater. And
Brown, yeah.
Yeah. And it's surprising, I think, for a lot of people, really, and Rhode Island in particular, I'm talking, looking at my notes here, and Rhode Island in particular, you don't think about it, but slavery and the slave trade had a tremendous economic effect here in the North, and people don't know about it.
Absolutely. And you know, and this was a real revelation for Melissa and I. You know, we had gone to Brown University, and, you know, and I was aware of the slavery connections with that came to the Brown brothers, who, you know, and all that. But what I Brown underwent a slavery study ordered by Ruth Simmons back in 2003. And it's really a revelatory document, which shows how Rhode Island, even more than any other New England state, was involved with Southern slavery. They're described in that study as the commissary of the Southern plantation system, where, you know, these plantations were all growing cotton. But what they really, what they needed were provisions and goods from the North, which Rhode Island eagerly provided. And so, you know, just about everyone in Rhode Island was involved in one way or another in slavery. You know, we mentioned earlier the cotton mills that would transform the American economy, particularly in the 19th century, and Rhode Island was very involved with that. And of course, these cotton, as was all of New England, but these cotton mills relied on slave, you know, grown cotton, and so. It was really clear before Melissa and I and Dora started our Southern tour, we visited Rhode Island just as Washington had. And it was a real, you know, it showed that the slavery was truly a national issue at that point. All North and South were involved. And Washington's journey provided us with, you know, really, you know, talk about an on the ground perspective on where the country stood, not only then, but today.
You know, the slavery issue within Washington himself.
Yes.
There was obviously an internal conflict. This is a Southern plantation owner, a slave owner, who I think fundamentally recognizes that slavery's got to go, that it's evil and it's got to go. And you described it at one point as, I'm going to quote you, the cold pocket of horror within Washington. And you made a couple of examples of how he treated a runaway slave on the judge, how they manipulated the time in Philadelphia for their own household slaves so that they couldn't gain their freedom. And this conflict between Washington's internal instinct to abolish slavery and I guess the economic reality for himself and his family that he couldn't just free his slaves outright.
Right.
Same conflict with Jefferson, who's mm-hmm. writing the Declaration of Independence and yet is a slaveholder who never actually freed his slaves in his lifetime or in his will.
Right. No, and this is, I mean, let's look at Washington. And one of the things I wanted readers to see is how far Washington traveled, not just, you know, in America, but as a human being throughout his life, particularly when it came to the issue of slavery. He becomes a slave owner at the age of 11 when his father dies and he inherits some slaves. I mean, this is a part of, you know, how he literally grew up. And but the revolution changed him. Leading an army made up of people from all over America, including African Americans, you know, Washington began to see things differently, particularly, his surrogate son during the revolution was Lafayette, a man who would later, a Frenchman who would later say that if he had known he was helping create a slaveholding country, by fighting in the revolution, he wouldn't have done it. I mean, you know, this is pretty extraordinary. And so, you know, Washington was very, was a unique Southerner. Yes, he grew up in Virginia, but he really had the political point of view of a Northerner. He was very different from Thomas Jefferson. He was all for the Constitution. His experience during the Revolution had taught him that America desperately needed a stronger national government. And, and he began to realize that the Union, and this was the most important concept in Washington's perspective, the Union, the future of that would be imperiled because of slavery. And he was quoted as saying, Jefferson records this in his notes at one point while Washington was president, saying that if slavery should ever divide this country, I will go with the northern part, which is a pretty extraordinary statement. That said, he owned slaves. Martha's previous husband had died and hit the slaves owned by that estate had intermarried with Washington slaves. It was a very complicated situation. Washington just could not free himself in the way he wanted to during his life. There were financial situations, there's all sorts of situations, this is not a perfect individual by any means, but I'm here before you today to say Washington's complicated relationship with slavery. Look, he was the only slaveholding founding father to free his slaves upon his death. You know, that is a very different man from the one who inherited slaves at 11. That said, you know, he had a very complicated relationship with slavery, and that's how America began. In a very, we're a country with ideals that all of us will be, are created equal, and each generation is trying to achieve that, but we all fail, as did Washington, as we did. That doesn't mean, I think, that we, cut ourselves loose of that past. We have to look at it deeply to understand how we got where we are now.
We tend nowadays to have these blurringly fast news cycles and social media, which is just replete with uninformed or ill-informed, even worse, opinion. And we don't take the time to really understand history, mm-hmm. and learning from history is labor intensive, and you need to really make the effort. And you can take an individual who may have had some flaws and may have done one or two things that today don't look quite right, but that doesn't negate the rest of the good that that individual may have done. And that's sometimes, I think, what we're losing in this nation, where everything now is red and white, red and blue, and yep. Right and left, and Democrat and Republican, and there's no sense of consensus forming. And I think that if Washington saw that today, I think it would really, really be troubling to him. And I think that he kind of foresaw that and hoped that that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Washington, look at by the end of Washington's second term as president, the country was racked by partisanship that makes it, you know, what we have today is bad, but it was really bad by the time Washington was done with his presidency. He knew that that was, you know, his bare knuckled politics is a part of the two-party system. That said, I think what would really disturb him, what he was struggling to do throughout his two terms as president, was to create a federal government that people trusted, that people would look to as, you know, something they could rely upon. This was what, you know, and it was not a government founded on a personality, Washington. For him, he wanted to make sure it was founded on law, something that transcended the ego of any one person. That's what he was desperately trying to achieve. And I think what would really disturb him about today is how so many efforts are being made to undermine our faith in government, to, you know, to inflame partisanship. Mm-hmm. And he was all about saying, calm down, let's talk about this. Let's compromise was a big part of where, you know, he saw the political process. And, you know, so I think if he had his example has relevance today, it's that, you know, if we are going to continue what he began, we each generation needs to reaffirm the legitimacy of government and the supremacy of law above any individual's, you know, attempt to break that law.
Time with you is running really short, but I want to mention two metaphors that you raise in the book. And early on, you use Washington's dentures and say that they are a metaphor for the nation. And I'm going to tell people you need to go back and read the book and understand the context here and a little bit about those dentures. And then the book ends with the balancing rock in Halliston, Massachusetts. And I will ask you, which of those two metaphors right now point more to where we are?
Oh, man. Well, I have to say, I finished this book just, you know, in the fall.
Exactly. Got to put it in context.
You know, the presidential election was about to happen. You know, I didn't know anything about the, you know, January 6th or any of that, but it looked, you know, things looked, and, you know, the metaphor of the balancing rock that Washington tried to push but couldn't, but eventually, for reasons no one knows yet, just recently fell over. For me, that was, you know, I have faith in America. I do. And I have faith in very little. I'm a very skeptical person. But when I finished that book, I was really worried. And you know what? I will continue to be worried, as we all should be.
Well, we need to be. We need to always be.
Be vigilant. But we also have to have faith. We have to have belief in a government, you know, not an individual. You know, and you know, if Washington started things, but he was handing a baton to us, you know, and so we got to keep running with it.
Mr. Philbrick, this has been absolutely fascinating. I could talk to you for hours, and thank you so much for joining us today. The book is Travels with George. It is a fascinating book, as I said, on so many levels. Even if you're not a history reader and you want to read an interesting travelogue, it's really a terrific time. So thank you so much for joining us, and give Dora a scratch on the belly.
I will. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much.
And thanks a lot.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.